Possession number 15590, Phil Plowright, reel 3.
Mr. Plowright, reel 3.
Mm.
You were telling me about a parade where you were the right marker in taking orders from Britain.
Right.
And what happened?
Yeah, we were supposed to open to close column distance, 13 paces, but I was number 5 marker, so I had to do a quick mental count on how many paces I'd got to take. And so the first guy set off 13 paces and the next one 26 and 39 and so on. And I seemed to be carrying on forever and walking into no man's land. And I lost count altogether. So I listened for the guy behind me coming to his 13 and then reckoned I was going to count 13 on top of him, which I did. And then the tap of the drum again, and you all turned to face where Tibby Britton was set off, where you set off from, where Tibby Britton was. And it was like a dog's hind leg. I'd wandered about 50 paces to the right or the left or something, and Tibby Britton came down and he said, "Potential officers and NCOs," he says, "you can't even count," and he said, "you can't even walk straight," and that sort of thing. He gave us a real dressing down. You felt really small, being a sergeant and all.
Was his voice really loud?
Oh, indeed, yes. Yes, he did. Because when he'd got the right markers lined up, he turned to the battalion, and they were spread all round this square, all the way in single file, or twos, or whatever. They weren't just standing there waiting for the command. And he shouted, "Battalion!" And he shimmered across the square. "On parade!" And the tap of the drum again. And everybody comes to attention, slopes arms, and marches on behind their markers. And then you get your distance and your dressing and that sort of thing, and then Tibby Britton takes over. And he's reporting to the adjutant. Well, he was a huge man, and the adjutant was a small man. And his name was Milnes Gascoigne. He was a nobleman of some sort, little weedy fellow with these lovely polished riding boots which came right up to his knees. Well, nearly over his knees because he was so small. And Tibby Britton strode straight up to him until he was within about a yard and crunched his feet down in a clat that came to attention and saluted and saying, and the adjutant's nose was nearly Tibby Britton's navel. And Tibby Britton saluted, see over the top of him, obviously. He couldn't see eye to eye with him, and reported the battalion present and correct. And then there was the inspection and marching up and down the things, you know.
What about the COs?
The CO came on horseback when he came on parade, and the adjutant was there as well. So Tibby reported to the adjutant, and the adjutant reported to the commanding officer. And then there was marching round the square and that sort of thing. The parades, we seemed to do nothing but drill and polishing your gear.
Were there any of the old tricks of polishing? I mean, it's not as simple as it as people might think, getting your kit perfect.
Oh, yes, yes. So
what tricks did they, or methods did they teach you?
Well, they didn't teach you anything, but you'd got your boots to polish. They had to be highly polished. And you'd got all your equipment to blanco. Your bayonet scabbard had to be polished, and the handle and the steelwork had to be polished. You got all your brasses on your equipment. You just have to strip those off, strip all the brasses off, blanco the equipment, and then polish and assemble ready for tomorrow morning. And you'd only got one kit. So if you were lucky enough to get the pass and you had an inspection before you went out, you had to be inspected by the orderly sergeant or the guard sergeant at the gate before you went out. And if you went out and you'd got your equipment to do when you came back, so it wasn't worth going out. And of course, there was still bombing in London, Blitz.
How did you get the shine on your boots, say?
Spit and polish.
Literally?
Yes. Yes, you could use water. You'd sometimes tip the tin lid up and put drop of water in and get your polish and dip the polisher in the water and then into your blacking and start polishing and then buff it off again and then start again, layer after layer. So that when you, if you scuffed your toes going in the pictures or whatever, when you came out, you'd got to sort of razor blade a little bit off to get it level again and then start polishing again. It was so thick, the polish was so thick on there. It's unbelievable how much polish and how much blanco we used. And there was a big boiler room down at Regent's Park, and we used to go down there after you'd blancoed and hang your blanco over the top of the pipe work. There were huge pipes there, big diameter pipes, taking hot water right around the barracks. And it was quite a big barracks, of course, Regent's Park. So you get them dry there and then start your brassoing and reassembling ready for tomorrow morning's parade.
Now, how did you take... I mean, so you'd not liked so much drill with the knots, you know, the Sherwood Foresters. You got a bit tired with the repetition. How did you take to this guard drill, which is even more?
Oh, it was...
And then all this...
It was very, very exciting at that time. You were really something, you know... When you were dressed up there, you were really dressed up. Overcoat and in pleats and your belt and bayonet on the top, belt and sidearms on the top of that. Polished and blancoed respirator.
So you actually got to like it?
I got used to it, I say that. There was something different, and of course London was very exciting.
Yeah, the Blitz was going on, How close to it did you come?
Yeah, they bombed... they bombed north of Regent's Park. What do they call that? Camden Town. Camden Town was at the other end of Albany Street and Regent's Park. And they bombed Camden Town. And we used to go down Camden Town. If you wanted a pint, that's where we went. And the sirens went, and everybody went into shelters. And when the all clear went, you could come out. But often it never went at all. And then you got to explain, if you didn't go back to barracks, you had to explain what had happened, as if they didn't know. But it became... No, I can't say that I did.
Did it shock you at all, what was going... You know, the bombing? Just the destruction of it?
Yeah, I don't think... I think it was something that we'd accepted. I don't think it... It didn't shock me as much as it would do now, for instance. If that's the way I can compare it.
Now, how long was this guards course, then?
It went on for, I think it was about 8 weeks.
And it was part, we'll sort this out now, that it was part of, all part of this business of you being a potential officer.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, why had you been picked out, do you think, as a potential officer? You might not know, of course, but...
Well, I don't know, I suppose mainly ordinary abilities. Probably good on football and good on rifle drill, and I could write a fairly decent verse and that sort of thing, and I suppose that was the basic one.
Now, this guards course was part of it.
Yeah.
What other things went towards this PTO thing?
I went on, the next one I went on was a weapon training course.
Now, this was your first weapon training, was it?
No, we'd had some basic weapon training before that, when we were at Bestwood.
Now, take me through the weapon training then. What about the rifle? Just to start with a basic one. How did they taught you to shoot?
Well, the first thing they teach you is the on the rifle is the mechanism, loading and unloading and that sort of thing. On the range, the basic things that aim the tip of the foresight in the centre of the urn in line with the shoulder of the back sight, with the sights that's aligned, aim at the target, and so on.
And that's a quote from the manual, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes. And then, of course, we went on to...
What do you think made a good shot, then? I mean, that was that was how you were to do it, but what made a good shot? If you just did that, would it be all right, or did you need other qualities?
Well, you needed physical fitness. It was no good going there if you couldn't breathe properly, or you couldn't control your breathing. You'd never get a good shot. I've got a first-class shot certificate, so I suppose I was a reasonable rifle shot.
So you had to be fit because of the breathing.
Yes.
What else did you
Steadiness, and so that you could hold your rifle without going up and down and so on. Good eye, and a good eye, as indeed in any other things you possibly did. Have a good eye for it. Same as the cricket, playing your cricket, you've got to have a good eye. The shooting is the same. There's no other skills.
So they taught you the theory, and then when would you get your first... Would they start you like that with two twos, or would you go straight onto the league?
We had indoor shooting, small bore shooting as well.
Was that a Bestwood or
I can't remember. No, I don't think it was. I think it was when we moved later on from Bestwood.
So you started with that?
Mm-hmm. And then on this course I went on, I went to Bisley. They'd moved from Hythe. It was the Hythe wing that had moved to Bisley. And I was in Artists Rifles at Bisley. I remember that perfectly well. And there we had all the infantry weapons. We had Bren gun.
Yeah. So would they reteach you the rifle?
Oh, you were always on the rifle. The rifle was always at the base of everything. We had, talking about the rifle, even on wet days when we couldn't go on the range, we had snap shooting in the billet with a man holding a disc up to his eye and lifting it up, and you got to take a shot at it while you got it up to his eye. That was in the barrack room, so it was too wet to implement to be out. This is the way that we did it then. And stripping your rifle and cleaning it and all the rest of it.
Was it important to keep it clean?
Oh, indeed, yes.
What difference did it actually make?
Well, the action of the closing the bolt, it's got to be free from grit and dirt and so on, otherwise it wouldn't have engaged. And, of course, your barrel had to be kept clean and shiny and bright. Bolt was bright, clean, and slightly oiled. That was the way and then with your 4x2 regulation cleaning material, and you pull through, and that was basic equipment. And your rifle was your own. You didn't hand it in; it was your own.
You took it with you everywhere.
You did, yes, yes.
Were there good and bad rifles?
Well.
I mean, not between makes, but I mean two Lee Enfields. Could one be better than the other?
Well, it was mainly on the way they were zeroed. And the way that the man shot them. I don't think... For instance, if there were two rifles here and we were two equally good shots, I could shoot one and get a ball, give it to you, and you wouldn't probably get a ball. The rifle would have to be zeroed to your requirements, because we all have individual differences in the sighting.
What do you mean by zeroing? How did you go about that then? That's interesting.
had a group, you fired a group, and knowing how to zero was one of the skills of it, if you like. You fired a group, and the group appeared consistently in one place, either to the right, the left, the upper, or the lower. If you got a group, you'd got something to zero to. If they were all over the place, it was nothing to do with the rifle, it was to do with the guy that was shooting.
So how would you actually, what did you adjust on the rifle to zero it?
You altered the force. If you were, say you were high or low, you made adjustments to the tip of the foresight. The tip of the foresight. You could move it up or down, and the shoulders of the U, you could lift those up a bit. If it was to the right or to the left, there was an adjustment to the right and the left to compensate for where you were shooting.
Is that on the U or on the foresight?
On the foresight, yes. And you...
So basically, this would allow the rifle to compensate for something that was slightly wrong with your shooting.
Exactly,
because
yes.
You always did it wrong, so the rifle could take into account
that's
that.
It, yes. If you were lucky, you got one that was compatible with you anyway, and you could make a hit with it from the first go. But the rifles I had, I had to certainly zero a couple of them.
And how would you zero? I mean, what was the thing you usually had to sort out?
Well, there was a bloke there, that an armourer was there, with different size foresights and the tools to give it a tap. But if you knew exactly what was wrong, you could tell him what you wanted, and then you had the opportunity to test again, you see.
You wouldn't do it yourself?
No. There was a hammer for tapping and that sort of thing, a little kit of little boxes full of different size foresights and so on.
So you'd tell them what, they'd look at where the group was, and they'd sort of fix it for you.
Right, yeah.
And what would they normally have to do to yours? Was there anything, you know, were you high, low, or...?
I think I was had a bit of a pull to the left, if I remember.
And that could be correct?
Yes,
it
could.
And that left you a first-class shot?
That left me with a good record, yes.
Well, presumably, if you hadn't got a zero rifle, you'd be shooting to the left.
Could well be, yes. But the great thing was the grouping. That showed the consistency of the man himself. But if he was swinging about and not going up and down and not breathing and that sort of thing...
Doing it, or...?
No. On rapid fire, you got to get five rounds off in so many seconds, which was fairly easy. But the use of the rifle was not for rapid fire, it was for picking people off, if you like.
So the...
Precision.
The automatic weapons had taken the place of
They'd taken over rapid fire, yes. You couldn't live with a rifle against a machine gun.
So as long as you could fire five off quickly, that was enough.
Yes, it was, yes.
That's the rifle dealt with. Now, you mentioned the Bren.
Mm-hmm.
How did they go about training you in the Bren?
We had, first of all, was stripping and cleaning.
Was it easy to strip?
Yes, it was, when you got used to it. It was a bit of a puzzle when you first started. But it became proficient in stripping it down and putting it back, and we used to have tests and competitions, one group against another, see who could get the gun back in action again in the quickest time. So there was stripping and cleaning, the magazine, the loading of the magazine, the immediate actions to be taken if the gun stops, or the drills you undertake.
Was it prone to stoppages?
Yes, it was, yes.
What were the main causes?
Gun stops. Immediate action one. Pull back the cocking piece. Reload and carry on firing. If gun doesn't fire, then there were various drills that you went through, which I can't remember now. But a lot of them were the magazine, which was slightly elliptical, and we fed the rounds, keep pressing them in until it was full, and the spring forced each round into the magazine. And sometimes they used to get jammed. And the firing block used to get jammed as well, the piston sometimes jammed, with one round being ejected and trying to get another one in at the same time. But the immediate actions to be taken were sufficient to remedy these things. But you'd got to do them rapidly. That's why it became a drill. You didn't say, oh, what the hell's up with this and what shall we do? It had got to be done quickly so that you could commence firing again. And these were the things, the skills that they taught us.
And those immediate, they worked?
Oh, yes.
Were there any stoppages where it would just stop, you know, and these immediate actions wouldn't work? I mean, was there anything it was prone to that was more serious?
Yeah, gun jamming through overheating and that sort of thing, you'd got a bit of a struggle on then. The best, the thing they used to say was, if the gun stops then, mount the tripod and make your escape immediately and ride smartly away. That's it, yes. Yeah, there were things
what
that...
What was the Bren like to fire?
It was very accurate, an accurate gun, but it didn't match the speed of some of the other things that the enemy used, for instance. But it was always a good old plodder and very accurate. You could fire single shots or you could fire short bursts with it.
Was the accuracy sometimes a problem if you wanted a dispersal? I mean, it
tended to wander a bit if you let go more than short bursts. If you pressed your finger on the trigger and fired the whole 20, it would wander away.
From a precision point.
Yes.
But what I mean is, could it give a spread of fire easily? It was good at firing at one thing.
Oh, yes.
Could you use it as a...
Oh, yes, you could, yes. Yes, you could. Yes, you could. Yes, you could. And there was a facility also for firing it on fixed lines. We didn't use it much, but it was used later on when we were in action, where the gun could be mounted on a swivel and you could swivel it along this point and cover a whole arc of fire, albeit random. But normally you could fire it from the hip, it was a mobile gun, or you could fire it the same as a rifle, precision-wise, fire in short bursts, and providing you didn't fire in long bursts, it would maintain an accuracy.
Firing from the hip, I mean... Was the recoil a bit much for people?
No, not really. No, you learned how to do it. There's a good handle at the front, and you grip the butt well into your side, and you could fire it from there. Pull the bipod, fold it back up, and you could handle it quite nicely.
So that's the Bren. Any other automatic weapons?
Yeah, we had the Thompson submachine gun.
How did they train you in that, then, the Thompson?
Again, it was... The immediate actions for clearing, the stripping and cleaning, and the rest of a Thompson was just getting the feel of it. You can't aim a Thompson, although you can fire single shots, but by the time you get it up to your shoulder, the because it's only a close range thing, it doesn't fire long distance. By the time you get up to your shoulder to fire single shots and aim, the possibility would be too late.
What sort of range did it have then?
About effective range of about 25 yards, 25 to 30 yards.
And how far, you know, how far would it actually shoot for?
I don't really know what the maximum length of fire would be.
So it was very much a close quarter.
It was close range work. It superseded the bayonet.
And you'd be looking to fire it. Well, you'd fire it from the hip.
From the hip, yes.
What was it like to fire?
Very easy, no trouble at all. It just a smart chatter. It was brisk chatter, and he just held it and fired it and pointed, taking a general direction.
And did it have any faults, as far as you were concerned?
The first Thompsons we had a cylindrical magazine, and I think they held 50 rounds. I can't remember exactly. and we used to rotate it to wind it up. Wind it up to the maximum, and then it was on the tension of the spring. So that when you pulled the trigger, the spring led it round one and kept entering the chamber. The rounds kept entering the chamber. But they used to jam. And, of course, they were bulky, the big cylindrical things. And then we had the ordinary clip magazines, which held 20, I think. I think it was 20.
Any other automatic weapons? I mean, had the Sten come out by then?
No. No, the Sten came out. We didn't have Sten guns. We had Thompson all the time. I think the Sten guns were issued later to the European landings.
What about the older machine guns?
Yes, we had training on the Vickers. Early days, we had another machine called a Hotchkiss. That was a Heath Robinson affair. I think that was a First World War French thing. We had the anti-tank rifle.
Looking at the Vickers and the Hotchkiss, I mean, you were a trainer, but was there any thoughts that you'd use them?
No, not really. The Hotchkiss gun, I never heard of that from about 1941. I never heard a word about it. The Vickers gun, the machine gun battalions took care of those. The Fusilier battalions, they were turned into machine gun battalions because the Vickers gun was a different gun to an assault gun. It was mainly used in defences, wasn't it, originally?
But why did they bother to teach you at all?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it was because there was nothing much else they could do but teach us. There was nothing much else going. They hadn't got the variety of weapons that we know about now.
What about, I mean, the forerunner of the Bren, the Lewis gun?
We had the Lewis gun. That was a similar thing to the old Tommy gun. You used to have to wind the magazine up. But the look.
Now, what about other weapons, non-automatic? Did you do any bayonet training while you were?
Yes, we did bayonet training all the time. Mm.
How did they go about it?
Well, it was mainly to build up the aggression, sort of hype you up. We had them on various exercises that we went on. There was often a bayonet charge and assault course, but I never knew of anybody using the bayonet other than for toasting bread and things
when
like that.
Being trained, was it seriously thought of as a weapon?
I don't think it was really. I don't really think it was because the Tommy gun was all the go then. This was the in thing. Let's have a Tommy gun. It's a lot better than playing about with a bayonet.
So it really was, as you think, just for aggression, to build up?
I think so, yes. I think so.